We now come to our second keynote speaker, Dr. David Slaughter. David is a professor at the Biological and Agricultural Engineering Department, and he was also director of the Biological and Agricultural Engineering Sensors and Instrumentation Laboratory, something of a mouthful, at the University of California, Davis. So, in fact, David comes from not very far away from here at all. David received his PhD at the University of Florida. He's a world leader in the development of non-destructive and non-invasive sensing systems for determining the quality, characteristics, and identity of agricultural commodities. And he's an expert in mechatronic systems for precision agriculture. He has 6 ASABI paper awards, and he holds 6 US patents related to innovations that he has developed in these topic areas. So I ask you to give a welcome to David.
Well, good morning, and I'm very happy to be here, and I thank John for the nice introduction, and I'm glad to have followed Margaret giving a lot of background information. So I'm David Slaughter, and I'm going to be talking a little bit about engineering technologies, specifically looking at essentially labor-intensive agricultural opportunities for reducing energy and inputs in agriculture. Before I begin my technical part of the talk, I thought as a Californian I'd take this opportunity to welcome you to California and to tell you a little bit about the place where you are, especially for those of you who are new to California. It's a large state, 100 million acres. It's about 1,000 miles north to south. So it's the third largest state in the United States behind Texas and Alaska. And it has quite a range in characteristics. So we have Highway 1 along the coast, and perhaps if you have a little bit of extra time, you can enjoy the views along there. But the 1 also kind of represents the fact that California is number 1 in many things. It's got the largest population of states in the United States. We're the 8th largest economy. But we also produce the most of many of the crops that we produce. We've got the highest elevation in the 48 contiguous states at Mount Whitney. And what's interesting is less than about 100 miles away from the highest elevation, we also have one of the lowest elevations in Death Valley. So it's a very interesting state, and I hope you have an opportunity to enjoy some of it. If you look at this map, this is a map of the economic value of crops. California, of course, has blessed with a climate, Mediterranean climate, and we have irrigated agriculture. So we have a lot of opportunity to choose the crops that we grow. And so the dots represent $10 million in economic value. You'll see the pattern of the dots in California are very similar to the geography. So we have the Great Central Valley where we are currently, but you'll also see a dense line of dots closer to the coast, south of Monterey. That's the vegetable area where we're producing most of the salad vegetables for the country currently. And there's a small, dense group of dots just above San Francisco, where the Napa Valley is, of course. In terms of farm size, as farm sizes go across the country, there's an increase in farm size from east to west. California has not got the largest farms. There's about 81,000 farms in California, an average farm size of about 300 acres. So we have large farms. We produce specialty crops, or what used to be called minor crops. And if we look at the things we produce, taking fruit, for example, California produces over half of the fruits enjoyed in the United States. So we have a lot of interesting commodities that are going on. So as we begin this conference this week and we begin to discuss a lot of the new knowledge, there's no lack of challenges to agriculture. President Obama's Council on Advisors has produced a list of topics, and this list comes as no surprise. We need to manage weed, pests, and pathogens and invasive plants. We need to, obviously, in California at this time, drought is a huge issue. Margaret mentioned water use efficiency, reducing our environmental footprint, climate change, and adapting for the demands of biotechnology. All the while, Margaret had mentioned the increased 35% in the world's population, so another 2 billion people in the next 35 years is going to be a critical issue. Specifically to my talk, I'm looking at pests and talking about technology for pests. And research, of course, everyone knows, shows that pests are a problem, reducing yields, and weeds are no exception. There's a large variability in what the ramification of weeds in a crop. This is a tomato field not that far from here. And depending on the competitiveness of the crop and the weed species involved, there can be a huge yield loss associated with that. Chemical herbicides in vegetables are not completely effective. So when they're applied, you still get a lot of weeds that have to be removed with hand weeding. And hand weeding is costly. I was just on the phone with an organic tomato grower in Colusa, which is about an hour north of here. And he was writing a $500 per acre hand weeding check to pay for hand weeding. So this is a crew very similar to the one. This happens to be a photograph in Winters, but another farm north of Sacramento. So what has been our technological progress, those of us working in technology? So maybe a century ago, we would see a scene like this with short-handled hose, labor in the field. How about today? Well, if you went to Salinas in the Watsonville area, you would see a very similar scene. There's no short handle, but they're still doing a lot of manual labor. So hand weeding is still a problem. And we think often in terms of agriculture about the cost in terms of yield and the cost in terms of labor, but there's also the health risk cost. And we know that stooping over and bending down for extended periods of time is not a healthy behavior. And so that, of course, has been banned, except in the case when there's no reasonable alternative. And as the Farm Bureau president says, in many cases then, the alternative is to use more herbicides. Oh, technological glitch of my own here. So herbicide use nationwide, and in particularly in California, we often have seen an increase in herbicide use. We have more acres that are being herbicides are being applied to. There's about 100 million pounds of herbicides applied per year in California. In some parts of the country, the use of herbicide-resistant crops has allowed some advantages, but we don't see that trend in California. The majority of herbicides found in the groundwater in California came from pre-emergent herbicides, herbicides that were applied to bare soil, herbicides that do essentially everything in antithesis of what precision ag is all about being smart, about targeting things. If we're broadcasting pre-emergent herbicides, we're buying them in a way that's not very, very smart. Organic weed control is a big issue, and it continues to top the list of priorities for organic farming, often the most important pest control problem for these farmers. So this talk is about automating weed control with the goal to significantly reduce manual labor and herbicide use. We don't have the technology to eliminate, but we hope to make significant contributions. The focus of my talk is on the most difficult part, which is removing the weeds within the row, the weeds that are most competitive with the crop plants growing in close proximity to the crop. And my work over the past decade is focused on technologies that are robust to hidden foliage, which is a big challenge, as you'll see in a bit. So an automated within-row weed control system typically consists of four pieces. Guidance technology is a commercial, well-established technology. It's very useful in doing cultivation between the rows. The second element is a plant sensor, and quite frankly, that's where the challenge has been and is greatest and still remains, is developing robust and accurate plant sensors. Weed control systems, there are a number of techniques that have been tried, and then, of course, a location sensor is a critical piece because often the plant sensor and the weed control actuator don't coexist either spatially or temporally. And so you need some way of converting the information from one sensor to an action. So in this talk, we're talking about proximal sensing. And a particular focus is at the centimeter scale. So we're not talking at the 30-meter scale or such, but we're looking at specifically very precise application of technology to control weeds. There are two cases I want to look at. One is where chemical applications are required. This means typically when you have very small crop-to-crop spacing, where bringing a mechanical tool in between the crop plants would typically be risky or detrimental, very difficult. So something like onion, where the plants are very close together. And in that case, we typically find that sensing the weeds is the best approach. When mechanical methods are possible, typically in a transplanted crop where the crop spacing are larger, then the focus switches to sensing the crop. So we're going to look at proximal sensing of these two approaches and look at some examples of some systems. Traditional machine vision, and so this is a photograph of a tomato field, and this is actually not an organic tomato field, but a tomato field, and there are a couple of tomato plants in the middle, if you can recognize them. You can see that this is a great challenge where the foliage intermingles between the different species. And so two-dimensional machine vision has a great problem with this, where you see these two shapes merge together and shape-based recognition is hindered greatly. And that's been one of the main reasons why we haven't seen commercial development of automated weed control machines. The approach that we've found to be very useful is multispectral imaging, which provides a robust alternative for weed recognition in this context, and I'll give you some examples of that. So multispectral imaging, of course, is an imaging technique, so you get a 2D image of the scene, but you also get more than three dimensions in the spectral dimension, so you get more than red, green, and blue, and in this case, we're typically talking on the order of 10 to 20 wave bands, but it's possible to have more than that. And then the advantage for weed recognition is that each pixel contains the full spectrum, and so that we can get information on a pixel-by-pixel basis. We don't need the spatial context of the surrounding pixels, so we don't need to know about the leaf boundary in such a way. So spectral recognition eliminates the need for leaf shape recognition, and it mitigates the occlusion problem where you have foliage hiding features that you're interested in. So this photograph is obviously a research prototype, but it's a multispectral imaging system mounted on a tractor. We're talking about fine detail in the spectrum, and so we need a controlled illumination structure. So what you see in the middle of there is a white metal chamber that is allowing the control of the illumination. And if you looked inside, you would see a camera, and then below the camera is an optic that allows you to get the spectral information, and there are a number of technologies that could be used. This is a push broom style spectral imager that gets the one dimension of the image in the travel direction as you move, and then you'll see the illumination source. So all of that is inside that white chamber that you see on the left in the center of the frame. And this is some data that was gathered. Each column, this actually is a single row, but to fit it on the screen, I split it up into six individual columns. So each of those columns there is a 10-meter section of the row. There are five species present in the field. And we see that the color coding there are the five species. And on a pixel-by-pixel basis, then, we're able to use a classification technique to predict the species. And in this particular example, we have error accuracies approaching 90% on a pixel basis. And if you then look at a majority rule, and the 99% is kind of foreshadowing the approach that I'm going to be taking is actually on a spray basis, we can get classification rates much higher than 95%. So what is the difference then between the plant and the pixel-based classification? Here you see about eight black nightshade weeds. So all of the weeds in this picture are the same species. They should all be the same color. And so green was chosen as the color for black nightshade. But you'll see on the margins there are some red and blue dots which indicate misclassification. And those are being misclassified. This happens to be a tomato field, so the crop is red is for tomato, and you see the red dots. Most of the errors are made on the margins of the leaves. There are a few errors for pigweed as well. Sources of error when you're going on a pixel-by-pixel basis, then insect damage, of course, causes changes in the tissue. We have irrigated agriculture, so we often do sprinkle irrigation. We can splash soil onto the foliage. There are a number of things that can cause certain parts to be misjudged. So then we can take this technology, this machine vision technology, and marry it with a weed control mechanism. And the example I'd like to give today is a thermal weed control system that we've developed. So on the left is, this is a photograph in the lab, but you'll see an outdoor version in a minute, the multispectral imaging system that you saw before. And on the right is a hot oil micro sprayer. And so this is able to spray very high temperature food grade oil onto the crop. The technique uses a single flow through system, not a recirculating system. So we have a pressure source driving through a heated chamber. So there's a reservoir for applying heat. And in the interior, there's an interior reservoir that has actually the compound that you're going to be applying. In this case, we're applying canola oil to the weeds. And on the right side, you see an array of valves. There are eight of them there, and each one is then controlling the application of the heated canola oil to a centimeter-sized region of the bed. So that you can see the nozzles are not traditional spray nozzles, but actually apply jet streams of oil to the crop. So this is a photograph showing the application of the hot oil in progress. So you can see two nozzles are active, two valves are open, and the nozzles actually have five straight streams of fluid coming out of them at high velocity. That's about 1 centimeter in width, and there are eight of them across. Here's an example with a black nightshade weed in a pot. This is what it looks like just after it has been sprayed, within a few moments of being sprayed. And this is what it looks like 24 hours later if the temperature is high enough. So there's some data that we have showing that if you do this at room temperature being California in the summer, it does the weeds do not care. There's no mortality of any kind. As you get close to the boiling point of water, you still do not have an effective system, and that you have to get up above 150 centigrade before the technique becomes viable as a weed control mechanism. So the precision spray concept involving a machine vision system and then a precision sprayer goes something like this. So you have an image, and in this case the image would be a hyperspectral image, but for the concept it doesn't really matter. Let's say there are two tomato plants and a couple of weeds. We overlay a grid on the image. The number of rows is fixed by the number of spray nozzles in the system. There are eight spray nozzles and eight valves, so we've got eight rows. The width of the columns is a function really of your choice. We typically choose that as a function of our uncertainty and our direction of travel, which is typically about 6 millimeters. So that determines the size. Once you know the crop locations, you can map those out and say those are grid cells that are not to be sprayed. Because we have uncertainty and not knowing where we're located, we put what's called a buffer zone. So we say those cells surrounding the crop plants should not be sprayed because we don't know within 6 millimeters exactly where we are at any one time. And then the weed cells then are mapped out. So those are the cells that we sprayed. So in practice then, you have the sensor coming first and making the map in real time, and the spray system coming afterwards. And so this is some field results in a cotton field. And you can see the cotton plants there in the top right. And the blue we were spraying, not herbicide, but a blue dye, so we could see visually, and you could see the ability to spray within a few centimeters of the crop plant. And so there's a couple of things. And there's, as I said before, a buffer zone in between the crop plant and the weeds. We've done an outdoor trial. It's a simulation in the sense that it's not a real row, but it's a row of potted plants. The plants are real, but the row is a simulation. And so what we have is tomato plants, and in between the tomato plants, weed plants are placed in random order. And so we have two weed species, black nightshade and pigweed. Of course, tomato is a nightshade. And the results are calibration, and it was a site-specific calibration, so a small portion of the plants were taken and a calibration was done. took 13 wave bands in the visible and the near infrared region of this multispectral imaging system, and we were able to get recognition accuracies. And again, this is on a pixel basis, in approaching 95%. Those are the color maps. You can see some of the miscolored dots on a pixel basis. You have to then imagine that you overlay the grid on top of those, and then you have to make a decision on a centimeter scale. So you then have a lot of pixels within a grid making a final decision as to spray or not spray. And this is some results then. 1 hour after treatment is shown the pots for the three different species, black nightshade, pigweed, and tomato. You can see that the black nightshade and the pigweed are shiny, which shows they were sprayed with the hot canola oil. And then 24 hours later, you can see that most of the two weed species have been killed. And about 15 days later, there would be a little bit of regrowth, but still quite effective. So it is possible then to marry an imaging system with a precision chemical treatment at the centimeter scale. We find it typically takes on the order of 12 to 20 wave bands. And that it, and with that number of wave bands, you can identify closely related species. We do find that there are seasonal effects, so that if you go from one season to the next, you have issues with the calibration. And so you either have to have some kind of a seasonal expert, or you have a big enough database that you can look into the database and see that, 2014 is very similar to some prior year, or you have to have what they do have done in Australia was a global database with about a decade worth of data to get robust performance. Weed control then can be automated by adding precision microspray to the imaging capability. And in this example, we had weed control, of course, in potted plants, not in the field, above 90% using very hot canola oil. All right, moving on to the second part of my talk. We're looking now at applications where mechanical methods are feasible. So typically you have a traditional cultivator, and so we see in this cartoon there are what's called the sweep knives that are between the crop rows that are cultivating in a traditional way. And with the advantage of automatic guidance, we can get quite close precision cultivation. So we can cultivate everything outside of about an 8-centimeter band if we have good guidance technology. And what we're talking about here then is this remaining zone in the middle, the inner row, the intra-row or the within-row part. And so you have to have some kind of a mechanism that allows you then to move a mechanical tool in and out of the zone. And there have been a number of, techniques that have been attempted. We're using a fairly simple technique. It's essentially got two miniature hoes. Each of the hose is about 3.5 centimeters wide, and together, when they're side by side, they occupy about a 7-centimeter wide zone. And when they are pressed together by the pneumatic cylinders at the top, then between the stationary sweeps on the side and the two red hose in the middle, you essentially are killing all plants in your path. When you come then to a plant that you're interested in keeping, then you can reverse the pneumatic cylinder positions and bring the red hose apart, as it's shown in the cartoon, leaving a gap for the crop plants to go by. And we've tried marrying this mechanical weeding technology with a number of other sensing technologies. Prior, we were having to identify the weed species, a much more complicated task. In this case, we're now really only interested in identifying the plant we want to save. And so we're only looking at recognizing the crop. I also have then the possibility of additional constraints or information in the system. And in the case of tomato, if you have a transplanted tomato, you have the advantage of height and size of the plant. And so this is a technique using X-ray sensing to sense the fact that you have a plant with a larger stem, a taller plant that you're interested in, and that's kind of your key characteristic. So this shows a schematic with an X-ray source going horizontal, parallel to the bed, slightly above the bed and above the weeds, and shining across the bed. And if you then have a tomato stem that happens to block that beam, then the detector on the other side will see less X-ray signal and it'll be detected. This is what the equipment looks like in the field. So that large green cylinder on the right side in the furrow is an electronically generating X-ray source, so you can turn on and off the X-ray with a switch. And there's a steel pipe that connects that then to this large kind of off-white metal enclosure. That's the X-rays travel down that. So you can think of it as a giant laser pointer with the X-rays traveling down the pipe. The metal enclosure is for safety because of the X-ray wanting to not let them get out. Inside, there is an X-ray detector. And so this is what the detector looks like. It's in a vertical array of pixels that are sensitive to X-ray. They happen to also be sensitive to visible light. So in the photo on the left, you see the black mask put in front of them to block visible light. And on the right, you can actually see the individual diodes. They're arranged vertically because we're nominally trying to sense vertical objects. And so by arranging this set of diodes in a vertical way, we have a better signal-to-noise ratio on tomato plants. This is some data taken in the lab when the tomato stem passes through the X-ray beam. So you can see the scatter in the voltage values around 3 when the X-ray is going through the air and nothing other than air is impeding the X-ray before hitting the detector. Then when the stem partially blocks the beam, you could see the voltage level drops where less X-ray gets to the detector. And that's essentially the idea of the system. Here are two photographs. One is the top view on the left, and the bottom is the ant's eye view on the right. And you can see then the pipe coming in from the right side, and it's containing the X-ray beam, and then the sensor is on the left side. You also see the black tunnel behind, right, and that's the enclosure to keep the X-rays from bouncing out of the chamber. So essentially the idea here is that the pipe is at an elevation that's high enough that most of the weeds are going to fall below that. But even if they did not, the basic concept is that the weeds are at least 2 weeks behind the crop in growth stage, and that the crop is larger, and therefore when an object blocks the beam, the larger diameter the object is, the more X-ray is blocked. So you have a continuous variable that you can choose a threshold to adjust your sensitivity. And it also, people, I get asked, why didn't you use just a laser pointer? And the reason is that X-ray scatters less, obviously, if you've had X-rays of your body when you pass through biological tissue. So X-ray is not affected that much going through foliage. So you can have a tomato plant with a canopy that hangs down, and they have a very small amount of light, X-ray scatter, whereas you'd have a very large amount of light scatter. So that's why in some crops you might get away with a light sensor, but in others you would not. So X-ray is a more versatile tool. This is some data going down a row. I believe this is 15 meters of row. The big black heavy band at the top is the X-ray going through the air. And then when the little black spikes come down, that's where the X-ray intercepted a large object, and in this case, it happened to be a tomato stem. The ground truth is coming from the bottom of the graph, so you see the green lines coming up. Those are where the ground truth was measured manually, and then the red circles is then the essentially showing you the deviation between where the stem entered the soil, which is what the green bars are, and where the X-ray thought the tomato plant was located. So we have a movie here. So in this photograph, this is essentially your perspective. You're going to be viewing this from the view of the knife, or behind the knife, actually, and you're going to be looking forward in the forward direction. But because of the metal enclosure, you can't make the movie from a top view. You have to make the movie from behind. So it will appear dark because the camera is inside the chamber. But essentially what you've got is a tomato plant that will come in, it will intercept the beam, and when it does that, the computer then will, using a time delay, trigger the knives to open and then go around the tomato plant. So here we'll see how my technology is going to do. There we go. So it stops. You can see the knives, the red knives there, and there's a pipe in front, and then when the tomato breaks the beam, and the knives open apart. Every time a tomato stem, so you could see the heavy canopy here and how a light, a laser pointer wouldn't be a very effective tool. So essentially detecting the large diameter of the tomatoes compared to the weeds. You can also see that precision guidance is going to be critical here because in order to make it fast, you don't want the knives to have to move very far. And so it's a compromise between how much time it takes to get the knives open, how far you move them away from the center line. All right, so here's some results. These were done, this was not done agronomically, but was done with video analysis looking at the distribution. So the computer was told to try to open the knives about an inch and a half in front of the plant and to close the knives about an inch and a half after the plant so that you would be weeding everything except a central three-inch diamond shape, essentially. Although in this case, the knives open in about 15 milliseconds, so it's actually more of a box shape that's not quite as diamond-looking as this. But you see the distribution here has a standard deviation of about a half an inch, which gives us a confidence interval about from a quarter of an inch to 2.5 inches. So a quarter of an inch is probably a little bit too close. We probably would do some root pruning if we await a quarter of an inch before we move the knives out of the way. And 2.5 inches is probably not killing as many weeds as we like. What is the problem here? Well, the problem here is that the tomatoes do not grow straight up, right? They lean over, right? And so in the case that the tomato plant is leaning away from you, is the case then that you detect, you think that it goes into the ground in the wrong place and you open the knives too late. And if it's leaning the other way, you open the knives too early. So that's why you end up with this a large deviation. And this graph is similar, except it's showing then the size of the unweeded zone. So we had an ideal choice of 3 inches of unweeded area. We have a standard deviation of 0.7 inches on the actual unweeded zone. So it gives us a confidence interval of having an unweeded zone as small as a half an inch, which is probably a little too small, all the way to 5 inches, which the farmer would prefer we didn't leave that many unweeded. But that gives you a little bit of an idea on that. And so I want to talk a little bit about another technique. So the techniques so far have required crop-specific or weed-specific information. They perform fairly well, but they require then knowledge or certain circumstances to allow them to work. So in the case of multispectral or hyperspectral imaging, you have to have a database, and you have to know how the spectrum of the weeds a priori. You have to know what weeds are present in the field, and you have to know how they're going to be affected by the environment. Or in the case of a transplant, you have to have that essentially that advantage of time, where the crop has grown for a period of time. In 1981, Bill Chancellor, who's a professor emeritus in bio and ag engineering at UC Davis, wrote this paper talking essentially about precision agriculture, although he didn't use that word, and talking about the nexus of information and energy and how we essentially, what precision agriculture is all about is how we can use information to trade for energy. And so we basically can, he said in his words, on this basis, attention, which meaning care, individual plant care can be given on a plant-by-plant basis, each one at an optimum time, and usually involving then savings in materials, which a lot of precision ag is about, is using resources wisely. But in the case of this talk, it's really more focused on labor and energy and energy in the terms of money. So based upon this concept, then we built a systems approach to weed control that is not then dependent upon specific knowledge of the crop and not dependent upon specific knowledge of the weed species and less dependent on the timing and having an advantage of one being older. You know, I like to say that this essentially could be planting popsicle sticks. But essentially it's a systems approach where we're marrying the planting technology, the bird in the hand concept, where we have information. We know for certain when we have the plant in the flat exactly what its species is. We don't need to think about it, right? And we place it in the ground, we know where we are. So we use RTK GPS then to map out each of the plants at this location. And this actually is not my original idea. This Srini Upadhyaya is in the audience here, did some work on direct seeded plants. But this is a application in transplanted crop and where we've taken it to complete the full system. So it involves an RTK GPS transplanter. And you'll see in this case then is, a prototype, a research prototype, where there's a traditional one-row planter for tomatoes in California. It has a couple of unique features. Of course, all planters of this type have a planting wheel in which the transplants are placed. But this one is an encoded planting wheel where we know at any one time where it is. It also has a high-resolution odometer. It has sensors, multiple sensors. We happen to have two GPS systems on here, but if you want to just use the tractor, then it has a tilt and a roll and a yaw sensor. So it can tell the orientation of the transplanter relative to the tractor at any time. And we'll actually have a three-row version of this on the tour available for people to see. How is the mapping done? Well, the transplanter has this planting wheel that has a number of arms on it, anywhere from 4 to 6 is kind of a typical number. And there are little rubber fingers on the end of each arm. And the planting wheel is connected via a timing belt to an encoder. And so essentially it records angular location of a shaft. So at any one time, by measuring the sensor, we know exactly what the angular position of the planting wheel is. The resolution is such that we have a resolution down the row of about 0.5 millimeter. So that far exceeds RTK GPS. So we know exactly where the planting wheels are placing things in the ground at a resolution of about a 0.5 millimeter. And we then are time stamping the time at which we place each plant in the ground and at the same time recording the GPS location of the tractor and any kind of roll, pitch and yaw orientation of the transplanter relative to that. And then offline, putting all of this data together to create a crop map, essentially an as-planted map. And this is some of the data that we've collected. We essentially have an RMS error on the order of between 2 and 3 centimeters. And so we can then locate the crop, all of the crop plants with that level of accuracy. And if you have your hitch sensors and roll and pitch, you can then use just a GPS system on the tractor. You don't need one on the transplanter, although you can do it that way as well. So again, we're going back to these mechanical knives, and again, you have these two red miniature hoes that come together, and as they come together, they're essentially killing all plants in the center, say 7 or 8 centimeters of zone. At the very bottom of the picture, you can see just the edge of the metal sweeps from the stationary part of the sled. When you come up to then a map location that you've recorded, you can then bring the two knives apart, and you can then go around whatever you've planted. So you don't need to know if it's there or not. In fact, we don't know if it's there or not. We're going around it on faith, and we can do that. So again, here's another movie. Let's see how this one goes. We're not inside a chamber this time, so you can see the sunlight. And so you can see the knives going open and closed, and the knives in this video are in the soil, so we're actually doing real weeding. And so at each location where you planted things, whether there's a crop plant or not there, you propel the knives apart. They come apart in about 15 milliseconds. They actually come apart faster than they go back together because you're going into tilled soil, but they work fairly well. So that is an automated system based upon knowledge of where you were when you planted. We've done some tests or field tests. This is done on the UC Davis campus farm. UC Davis has the largest campus of the 10 UC system. We have a lot of blessed with a lot of nice farmland to do research. We did a couple of tests here. This is processing tomatoes. Each field had 8 control rows and 8 trial rows for the GPS system. We measured our performance in terms of labor savings. So we measure our performance in terms of the residual time it takes for a hand laborer to come through after the machine. So if the GPS is doing an excellent job, they would just be taking a stroll through the field and not stopping. If the GPS is not doing well, they have to stop and remove the weeds that the GPS did not do. The first field had about 24 weeds per square meter, and the second one was a little weedier. Accidental killing. We were a little conservative, and so we didn't kill very many tomato plants by accident because of the GPS error. And statistically, on average, there was no significant difference in plant numbers between the control and the GPS weighted. We've actually done a subsequent trial in Colusa where we took it all the way to yield, and there was no yield difference. Tomatoes are very adaptable. If you lose a tomato plant, the surrounding tomato plants will fill in, and so you get benefit. So if this was head lettuce, it would be a different story, but in tomato, there's some adaptation there. In terms of the hoeing times, here are the two distribution box plots for the two different fields, and you can see in both cases the GPS system took the workers took less time to follow behind the GPS system than in the first case. There's more variability in field one than the other, but the differences are significant. Challenges. Well, often the weeds remaining are close to the crop, right? They're in this zone that's been called the close to the crop or the safety zone. They're the ones that are the most difficult. We're leaving the hardest weeds to weed to the worker, right? The easy ones, the ones that are very far away from the crop have been removed mechanically, right? So in this case, here's a tomato and then a weed growing very close beside that, right? So that's a technological challenge. And it's not just a technology problem for a robotic system, but the human, this person decided, no, I don't trust my aim with the hoe. I'm going to reach down and pull that weed by hand. So that's the difference. And in this case, the hoeing time savings becomes a nonlinear function of the percent of land automatically weeded. So in this case, we were aiming for weeding 75% of the land automatically. But the 25% that we're leaving is not as in the same level of difficulty as the 75% that we weeded automatically. Right. So increasing difficulty is observed in removing weeds close to the crop. Right. So here's a tomato stem and here's a weed stem, and you can see how close they are together in addition to having the problem of visually trying to separate them and figure out where they are. And the time then the worker spends visually searching, either because they're there or not, is a problem. And we had problems where they were looking for weeds that didn't exist, and we observed some of that. So you can see here some of the actual performance. So we saw 52 and 45% labor savings following a GPS system. So mechanical weed control is essentially removing about half the burden, and we weeded somewhere in the two-thirds to three-quarters of the land, but we got half of the benefit. So some conclusions. Modern sensing and control systems can achieve significant reductions. We are able to cut the labor requirements in half. And if we are applying herbicides, we can be applying herbicides at the centimeter scale. So we can hopefully reduce the amount of pre-emergent herbicides that are used and switch over to more post-emergent applications where we only spray when there's a weed present and don't spray the bare soil. Weed control in close proximity to the crop, less than an inch away, is going to be a challenge. It's a huge challenge mechanically to get a knife in there with some uncertainty in where we are without damaging the crop. And so it will still require some follow-up manual labor, at least in the next few years, before we get better GPS and other things, or herbicide applications. And that includes what I have to tell you.
Well, thank you, David, so very much for that presentation. I'm sure you're breathing a sigh of relief that your technology paper presentation was not beset by technology problems.
That's we right. I was afraid the Macintosh would get a bad reputation.
We didn't even notice. We have time for one or two questions. Roving mic somewhere. Yep. Oh, I don't know which came up first there, but there. So, Ray Hunt there.
Yes. First, it's a lot of great technology. But I've worked in hyperspectral remote sensing for a long time, and California is basically the home of hyperspectral remote sensing. No expert, including Susan Houston at Davis, will claim the accuracies you got. I really don't know why you got those accuracies, but they're just way too low. They're way too high, and there's something you're doing wrong.
But certainly, the spectral differences are small.
But you're also not accounting for the variation. variation among the plants. You're probably self-selecting very uniform plants. There's much more overlap.
It certainly is a small population, right? And so when you see the trials, you can see that the populations are small. And so the research plots are typically less than an acre in size, right? And so certainly the homogeneity within a one acre plot, and also they're all, of course, planted on the same date and at the same time. So there are certainly... Yes. Well, that is why GPS is maybe a better long-term solution. A good point. There is that problem.
I'm sure that'll continue that discussion afterwards.
Right. Yes.
Hands up quick. Yes. One over here. Oh, sorry, you have it already. Okay.
Yes.
Yes, thank you. Nice presentation. And a quick question. With moving knives, what was the highest travel speed that you could do without too much damage?
We typically have had ground speeds running anywhere from 1 kilometer per hour all the way up to 4 kilometers per hour, but our comfort zone is in the 1 mile an hour, 1.5 kilometer per hour range. You know, I think that as time goes on, the technology will become more comfortable. You can see increases in ground speed. The knives are opening in about 15 milliseconds, so that ultimately will be the high-end limit on how well you can get a mechanical knife out of the way. And there are some other designs that are use a RoboCrop, for example, it uses a rotating knife. But typically, the ground speeds are in the 1 to 2 mile an hour range currently. It's kind of where our comfort zone is. If you come on the tour, you can actually see the knives and how fast they move, and you'll get kind of an idea. Yeah, things can go wrong in a hurry if you get 3 miles an hour.
Okay, thank you. We have a question at the back there.
David, a couple points. One, your technology, I think, has begun to be incorporated by, there's companies like there's that San Diego company, Vision Robotics, but they've used, instead of your hot canola oil, they just use high concentrations of nitrogen, and it seems to be working quite well for them. And I've seen some of their tests down in the Salinas area. It seems to do a very good job of thinning on that. That's point one. Point two, which kind of contradicts that a little bit. Two, there's no question that these mechanical systems, especially for all of the organic growth that continues to perpetuate here in the state of California, are going to be necessary. But my question would be more, are you seeing that many weeds when you switch from furrow irrigated over to drip? Because we certainly have seen a huge drop in our weed populations when we've switched from using furrow irrigation over to drip.
So the first comment is a good one there. I know that the technology he refers to is a spray thinning of lettuce, and there are 4 commercial systems now using machine vision recognition of lettuce plants and then spray thinning, so that's not weed control. And the first systems did use nitrogen. I believe they're using a organic herbicide. It's either Sharp or Shark. I'm not sure exactly what the name, and a lot of them have switched over to that. The problem is you can't use something like glyphosate because it's not registered in the crop. So certainly that's a challenge. There have not been much development in herbicide for vegetable crops, and that's one of the problems. In terms of your second comment, skill and luck are also involved in weed control populations. And so we've had the same farm where they were putting $500 an acre into hand weeding bills. They also have had some fields that had almost nothing. And so by delaying irrigation as long as possible after the crop was transplanting, essentially pre-irrigating, do a lot of good management practices, you can see something. So on the same, so if you have a 300-acre tomato farm, then on a 50-acre block, you can have one block that has not very many weeds. And some of it is by luck with the weather, and some of it is by skill. And so that is quite a bit of variability in cost. And drip irrigation might be one of the key aspects of that.
Okay, thank you. Another question down here.
We know that tillage actually stimulates weed germination. So your concern about actually getting those weeds really close to the plant, are you looking at any plant competition elements, just allowing those very close weeds to be outcompeted by the crop and not worrying about the technology?
Right. So in certain crops where the crop is competitive, then you can get shading and competition. In other vegetable crops, such as pepper, you can't get good. The crop is not a very good competitor. So it's kind of on a case-by-case basis. And I also think, you know, the issue of stimulation of weeds due to tillage is also a little bit tied in, as Bill mentioned, with the what the irrigation practices are and a lot of other factors. So I think you're going to have to kind of look at that on a case-by-case basis. So, but yes, and certainly in a competitive crop with a weed species spectrum that's not as competitive, you might be better off not doing the root damage to the crop and seeing if the crop can outcompete. But it's a good point.
Okay, one last question over here.
Hi, I have a question about the RTK signal. Do we have RTK in all California?
I think you can get a subscription service for the correction signal, but most farmers have their own base stations. So they're either buying a subscription service that's providing the correction signal, or they have invested in the base station, so they get the technology. And certainly with all the satellites now, RTK GPS is not as much of a problem as it was, say, 5 or 8 years ago.
Thank you.
Well, we've had two very interesting and contrasting keynote presentations, and I'm sure you want to join with me in giving both Margaret and David a real resounding... Right, we come now to the full program for the conference. You've all had, I trust, the program details, so I'm not going to go into details for you. You've got it all here. The full papers are available for you on the website for you to look at. After this plenary session now, we've got a coffee break, and then we go into parallel technical sessions. Two very important points. First point, mobile phones, cell phones. My wife groans every time my phone makes yet another different sound. Can you please ensure that your volume is turned right down to zero on your phone? It's just plain discourtesy if your phone rings in the middle of a session, so please ensure that. Point number one. Point number two, for copyright reasons and also in consideration of the others in the session, photography is not allowed. Now, I know some of you love to take photos of all the slides on that screen, but as I say, photography is simply not allowed. And session chairman, please ensure that that is enforced. A couple of more general notices. There are, of course, inevitably small changes in the program from what's in the actual printed program. Those changes will be posted on notice board at reception, so please keep an eye on that. For those who are presenting posters today, will you please ensure that your posters have been mounted by 4 o'clock this afternoon? And when you've got parallel sessions, it's absolutely key to keep to time. So session chairs, please be very rigorous and dictatorial and keep your speakers absolutely to time. With that, go and enjoy a coffee. Thank you.